This is Carla Dedesi with Your Family Matters here at 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty here in the Philadelphia area. Thinking about and honoring the Sanctity of Human Life Month here in January 2015, I feel very blessed to have with me on the phone Jeannie Mancini. She is in D.C. She is the president for March for Life. That we all get on our buses here, Jeannie, in Philly, and we go down and we march with you. So thank you so much for being here with us this morning.
Oh, gosh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for doing the interview.
It's my pleasure. Tell us a little bit about what we can expect. What is the date of this year's march?
Well, as most years, except inaugural years, the march is on the actual anniversary of Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton, which is January 22nd. So this year it's a Thursday, and you can expect much of the same and some fun differences as well. So maybe most important to mention to your listeners is our theme for this year, and the theme is Every Life is a Gift. Every life is a gift, and we have somewhat of a subtle sub-theme being the little ones who receive a poor prenatal diagnosis, a disability diagnosis such as Down's or trisomies or something like that. And we're emphasizing that in particular because those little ones are disproportionately targeted for abortion.
Mm. And as we know, there's so many, how do we say it, false positives where those precious little lives that may have been snuffed out would have been athletes. I mean, you think about Tim Tebow's testimony and that his mom was encouraged. But of course, you and I know, as many of our listeners know, that even if that precious child was born with only five fingers instead of 10 or with Down syndrome, God only makes miraculous.
Absolutely.
Fearfully and wonderful everything.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I think you just hit the nail on the head with both of the points that you just made. A, often those tests are, first of all, they're screening tests. They're not diagnostic to begin with, and they're very frequently not accurate. And so it's not, you know, something to inform you for the rest of your life. It's something that might provide some education for the future. So that's the starting point. But then the second thing is, you know, I think we're asking the wrong question to begin with when we're focused so much on the accuracy of the test and the quality of life, because the truth of the matter is that every human being is a gift, as our theme says, and every human being has inherent dignity, regardless of how they were conceived, of if they have a disability, of if they're quote-unquote perfect or not. Of course, none of us are perfect, but every human being has human dignity.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're reminding me of something that happened in my own life where my first child, Victoria, who is now 14, Jeannie, oh my goodness, I can't even believe it. She, I had a false positive with her. They were saying that she was Down syndrome and they wanted me to go in and they wanted me to have an amniocentesis. And I said, absolutely not, because I had read that if you did have an amnio, that there could be a higher percentage for miscarriage. And my husband and I and my family, we were thinking, gosh, if there's already something happening with this precious baby inside of me, I don't want to heighten any risk to that child, you know?
Good for you. Then
God was just, you know, gives me always more than I deserve or can imagine. And Victoria is a very healthy child. But again, so that was a false positive there. And sometimes I really think that a lot of these tests are just unnecessary and really give moms and dads a lot of anxiety, unnecessary anxiety.
I agree. And they're also quite unregulated. Mm-hmm. There's a new one that just came out. I came out about 3 years ago. It's called Maternity 21. And it's much less invasive than the amniocentesis test. So this is another screening test, again, not diagnostic. And there are many false positives in this. There was just, in fact, a huge article, I think it was earlier this week, it was either late last week or earlier this week in Boston Globe, all about this, and a young woman who received a false positive and was really had an appointment to terminate her baby the next day when the doctor called back and said, hey, you know, you're acting too quickly, et cetera, et cetera. So it's scary, and they're becoming more and more prevalent, these tests.
Why do you think our culture, our moms and dads, are craving these screenings? I mean, do we all want perfection, a perfect child, so greatly? Like, what are your thoughts? I know we're going off topic a little bit.
No, I mean, I love this topic, actually. I honestly, if I were to try to put my finger on it, I think it has to do with our understanding of quality of life, for starters, and then I think also an inordinate need for control in our lives. I mean, as you know, we're very privileged as Americans. I've had the blessing to travel internationally quite a bit with jobs and just different things, and it's so interesting to come back to the United States, and I love being an American, so just to be clear, I absolutely love it, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, but we're very privileged in terms of resources that we have here, but all of those privileges can sometimes lead to this false sense of that you have really control over everything and control over your future, and you know, that we've got so many things like right at our fingertips, and especially with social media and the internet and how much information is right at our fingertips now, we can have this false sense that we have everything sort of in our hand. We only have to take in so much information, or we only have to buy the right drug to make such and such perfect, you know? But that's not the case. That's not at least how I live. I really believe that that God, that a higher power, is very much in control of these things. And we, of course, have free will and what have you. But the other thing is that we're very much focused on this idea of perfectionism. Mm-hmm. There have been a few interesting science fiction movies that have come out over the years. There was just one earlier this year. The title of it is leaving me right now. Maybe I'll remember before the interview's over. But it's this idea that if there's anything sort of quote-unquote less than perfect, so like a disability or somebody has maybe a blue eye and a brown eye or something like that, that's less than ideal. It's sad because, first of all, that's trying to control something that we're not ever meant to control. I mean, there's such a beauty in the uniqueness of every person and in differences, not in sameness, and no one's perfect. I mean, there's not anyone who's perfect.
Well,
the whole quality of life thing is also interesting as well. It might be something to talk about later on.
Right. And I also agree with you that we all know there's people that go to my church that have adopted 6 children with Down syndrome. This family, they are the happiest people in the world. Quality of life? It's off the charts.
That's exactly what I was just going to say about
and
the
you know what?
Life. Yeah.
We all know people, because I'm thinking of some in my mind, who have what appears to be perfect, gorgeous Barbies, and they're miserable.
Yeah.
And I look at them and I think, ugh, wouldn't want that quality of life.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that we are working, especially you down there in DC, to change the younger generation's perspective on what is quality of life. I would agree with you that it's not this Hollywood, Dollywood, plastic perfection. I mean, let's embrace our uniqueness and our differences, and actually let's embrace what we think might be a disability.
Or even what we might consider to be a lack of something, a quote-unquote lack, that can often end up being a blessing in disguise.
Yes.
I mean, what you just said about that family with many children who have Down syndrome and how happy they are, this is actually quite interesting to me. There was a study that came out of a Harvard researcher, Dr. Brian Scottko, 3 years ago or so. And it was a huge survey measuring the subjective happiness of families with Down syndrome. And their happiness levels were off the chart. I mean, I think if we were going to compare them to the average American, they genuinely seemed happier. And this was both the people themselves with Down syndrome, just self sort of identifying and explaining, you know, their own personal feelings about these things. It was also the parents. It was siblings. Some of them were adolescent siblings, which, you know, the average adolescent, as you know, with young children, the average adolescent doesn't usually rank themselves as highly happy and content with their siblings. So I think, yeah, I totally agree with you that this idea of the Barbie doll in Hollywood, that's not the goal. But sadly, that's sometimes our culture kind of sends those messages.
Right. And they're a very strong message. Let's get back to our March for Life 2015 on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, Thursday, January 22nd. The theme is Every Life is a Gift. I love that theme, by the way.
Great.
Tell us about the speakers. Who's going to be there?
Well, we're really excited. Instead of doing kind of big, flashy Hollywood type speakers this year, we're taking people who live very gifted lives and who are very much intertwined with this theme to speak. So one of our speakers is a friend of mine, Kristen Hawkins. She heads up the wonderful group Students for Life of America. She has a beautiful little son named Gunnar, and he's had a pretty serious disability. And so Kristen's going to share her story a little bit. Another amazing woman who lives in the D.C. area. Her name is Kathleen Wilson, and she runs these different shelters that take in expectant mothers, including trafficking victims and what have you, people who've really lived very, very difficult lives. And her name is Kathleen Wilson. We have a wonderful, very well-known Latino preacher, Reverend Sammy Rodriguez, who's going to be, he's with the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, and he's going to be speaking at least for a few minutes and then closing us in prayer. We also have Carl Anderson, who is with the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic a Catholic organization. He's going to be speaking as well. So we've got lots of wonderful speakers. We also are really excited because, of course, we've got some wonderful new female pro-life legislators in office. For example, Senator-elect Joni Ernst, another one, the youngest congresswoman ever, Elise Stefanik from New York, and they're invited to speak. We'll have a small handful of legislators speak, but we're really trying to hit our young, powerful, pro-life women on the Hill.
Excellent. It sounds so electrifying. And
it's pretty fun.
It is fun. How many people, how many marchers did you have last year? Listen, I do not like to cling to the numbers because I'm one of those people that thinks if you have 100 people with a powerful voice and they're really going to do something and be proactive, they're better than a million people who are dead weight.
Right. But I agree with you.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the truth. But what are our numbers that we can look to see?
So we have not had a formal estimate conducted in a number of years, although we do actually plan to have one conducted this year. But what I would say is that I believe it's in the hundreds of thousands. And I think that's a really fair number. I don't think we're blowing that up at all. The last time a formal estimate was conducted was when the National Park Service through the government was still conducting them. They, at a certain point in time, for political reasons, they actually just stopped doing these estimates. But I think at that point we were at like 500,000 or something like that. And it goes up and down depending on like what day of the week it is and if it's a major anniversary year or what have you. Last year we had a pretty significant snowstorm, but and I was shocked.
I remember.
We still had hundreds of thousands of people here. I mean, it literally takes hours to walk past the Supreme Court. There's just mobs of people walking past the Supreme Court for hours.
And tell us where we start and where we end for those of us who have never marched.
Great. And this year, it's going to be a little bit different for those who've come in the past few years. We're actually shutting down 14th Street, which any of you who are familiar with D.C. know that, that's really significant. We haven't done that in many, many years. So the rally is going to be on the Mall at 12th Street, and that will begin right at noon and finish right around 1 o'clock. And then the march itself will start at Constitution and 14th Street. And so the marchers will continue all the way up Constitution Avenue until they come to 2nd Street. And then they take a right onto 2nd Street and pass the Supreme Court.
Such an exciting walk. And I just want to encourage all of our families, all of our listeners, that this is something where you're going to be getting exercise. You're going to be meeting a lot of new friends. You're going to be meeting people who are like-minded. And you're going to be walking, marching for a cause. And honestly, I think that these numbers, to say that you have hundreds of thousands of people out to these marches in January, in the dead of winter when it's freezing cold out.
It's cold.
This is highly successful.
It's pretty neat. It's actually the largest pro-life event that we're aware of in the world annually, and it's just pretty mind-boggling. I sometimes feel that my role at the March for Life is just to kind of bring it into the light. In other words, the truth about abortion, to bring that into the light, and then also, though, the truth about the March for Life. I mean, to show the media the real, you know, pictures and the young people that are there. We have hundreds of thousands, and then even more wonderful is the fact that a large majority of them are young people age of 25. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Which is really exciting, and I think that that's truly been happening like in the last 5 years. I think we're turning a corner here.
I think so, too.
I agree with you, and which is a valid point that you bring up, that I think that you do not get as much coverage as you should on all of the networks.
I agree. Now, I noticed a marked difference in the last few years, and we at the March for Life have approached media quite differently over the course of the last few years. So I think it's fair to say that we're moving in a very positive direction. Last year, for the first time ever, the media was reporting pictures of the young people. I mean, you could really tell how many people were there from, and it's just not something that they normally do. So that was exciting. And they turned out in much larger numbers than we'd ever seen before. And this was all the major TV outlets. So that was exciting. Now, is it accurate coverage? Is it fair? No, not yet. But I think we're moving in a good direction.
We're moving in the right direction. Let me tell you why. And you might giggle at this. But my husband and I, our date night would be on Sunday evenings. We'd watch Downton Abbey together. Are you a Downton Abbey fan?
Yeah. You know what? I've never watched it from the beginning to the end, but I've heard wonderful things about
it. Okay. Well, we love the BBC. We started like with season one with them. Nice. Lenny and I watched, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't. Well, you know what? It's too bad if people didn't watch the last episode to see what's happening. Because I'm telling
Spoiler alert.
Okay. So just turn it down if you don't want to hear this. But, and it was out a year ago, so everyone should have watched it at this point. But my husband and I are watching this Downton Abbey series, which is like, they have millions of people viewing in Jeannie on Sunday evenings.
Yeah.
And this woman in the 1920s, who's an aristocrat, gets pregnant out of wedlock. What is she going to do with this child? What is she going to do with this baby? And she is sitting in one of these back alley abortion clinics, which you can imagine in your mind. Think of 1920s, you know. And she's sitting there and she's with her aunt. She hasn't even told her family. And the aunt keeps encouraging her, like, are you sure you want to do this? And they're saying, baby, 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 it's a life, it's a life. You haven't even told the man who's the father. And in this scene, she ends up coming to the conclusion that she is carrying a life, a child, a baby inside of her. And she gets up and she leaves. And wow. I thought, like, my husband and I, like, wanted to stand and do, like, a, you know, a standing O. because we thought, oh, my goodness, is this Hollywood that's producing this? That this woman realizes that it's a life inside of her and she chooses life for her baby. But I really think that the tide is turning for our pro-life movement because...
You know, there's something to that. I really do think culture is upstream. Well, no, here's what I'm trying to say is that I think sometimes the movies and the different shows, they totally reflect what's going on in culture. And so for Hollywood to portray that a baby is a baby, it's not a lifeless blob of tissue, and
right.
to, you know, make it quote-unquote cool and glamorous that someone back then was such, you know, forward thinker or whatever... And I think it's incredible that they're showing it as it really is. That's
right.
really fantastic.
Right. As opposed to a few months ago when all over Facebook was this woman who's having an abortion and she's comparing it to just having her wisdom teeth taken
yeah.
out, which is just an absolute untruth.
Right.
And it's really, personally, I think it's child abuse for people to even want to say that message that taking the life of a child is just like getting your wisdom teeth out. It's
yeah.
just diabolical,
yeah.
really. But okay, so let's go back to the March for Life again. We can, how do we go online? Do we sign up? Do we just show up?
Yeah, I would highly encourage your listeners to go online. We're at marchforlife.org and to check out all of the resources that we have.
Okay.
We're really trying to make this easier for you all this year. We've got a fun trip planner. We also have a trip finder. If anyone in your area doesn't have like a bus to go with and they don't want to go on their own, they can look up and find other people that are coming from the Philadelphia area and are traveling down and go with that group. You can actually like put a little pin prick in the map showing that you're coming to the March for Life. There's all sorts of neat things. Especially the trip planner really shows how to make this more of a human dignity tour versus just a trip to D.C. for this. It ties in like other things that you can do in the area to really make it more impactful. So above and beyond all of that, we also have just other activities that are really, really great. I mean, I'm very excited about them. The day before the march, we have our conference and expo, which, by the way, is totally free. So anybody who's traveling can come. And now you do need to register for the conference itself, but the exposition hall you can just go through. You don't need to register for that. But the conference has wonderful different tracks. One is a legal track, and it's the best seminar I've ever taken, ever, on abortion issues. And it's a guy by the name of Carter Sneed from Notre Dame, and he's giving a seminar from Roe to Hobby Lobby. It's all of the major Supreme Court decisions on abortion. Yeah, it's going to be fabulous. I highly encourage folks to go to that. That's the day before the march in our hotel, which is very close to the march site. There's also, for folks who want to learn how to interact with their legislators, whether they're pro-life or pro-choice, this is a way to learn how to more effectively impact your legislator. So there's a Capitol Hill 101 that's going to be run that morning and that afternoon as well. Youth rally in the afternoon, which is always very popular. In fact, I think it's already sold out. And then also that afternoon, there's a Culture of Life panel, which is all linked to our theme, and we've got some amazing speakers for that. You can go on our website and find all of that out. For the really strong of heart, there's a 5K run on the morning of the March for Life, and I did it 2 years ago, and it's really fantastic, but I mean, it's cold. It's cold in D.C., so it is for true runners and the strong of heart. We also have a rose dinner for anybody who wants to stay and just enjoy a great speaker. We've got Carl Anderson speaking that night. Have a great, great dinner in the hotel, and we'll have, you know, a few different remarks. It's a really nice, nice evening after the March for Life that evening.
As a homeschool mom, I'm thinking that you should tap into the homeschool groups and get them out there for all of these wonderful events.
Oh, gosh, it's so true. Absolutely. Absolutely. And speaking of that, of young people and homeschooling and schools and all of this, we really try to engage social media in a robust fashion. And we do sort of a full court press with social media starting in January. But there's all sorts of things that young people can do throughout the whole month on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and what have you to show how they're pro-life. Especially we encourage people to use this hashtag #WhyWeMarch and to tell people why it's important, why they're coming to the March for Life. So all of that is on our Facebook page and it's on our website, so you can check that all out.
Thank you so much, Jeannie Mancini from March for Life in D.C. We hope that we get insane numbers out this January 22nd, 2015. Thank you for all the information.
My pleasure, and thank you so much for doing the interview. Really appreciate it.
This is Carla Dedessi with Family Matters here, 2015. We are designating this whole entire month to pro-life champions. And I am thrilled this morning to have Abby Johnson here with us sharing her pro-life advocacy movement and her plans and her dreams and her goals for 2015. Abby is a former abortion clinic director. She is the author of the book Unplanned, which was launched in 2011. She also has a blog, abbyjohnson.org, if you'd like to hear the epic things that she is doing. Abby, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you share a little bit about how you were an abortion clinic director and what happened with your life that you became a pro-life advocate?
Yeah, I worked inside of Planned Parenthood for 8 years. I started as just, you know, kind of the everyday health center, medical assistant sort of work, and eventually worked my way up to running a local abortion clinic outside of the Houston affiliate, which is the fourth largest Planned Parenthood affiliate in the country. And, you know, believed I was there to help women, believed I was doing the right thing. And then a series of things kind of happened. I was asked to increase the abortion quota, so the amount of abortions that we were to sell to women coming into our clinic, which really flew in the face of what I believe we were trying to do at Planned Parenthood. I believe that we were trying to reduce the number of unintended pregnancies. That's what we said we were trying to do. But I realized that as I got higher up in management that, you know, either the goals of the organization were changing or I was just now figuring out what the original goals of the organization were in the first place. And I think it was probably the latter. And so that was one of the things that bugged me. We were also expanding late-term abortion inside of my affiliate, aborting babies up to 25 weeks gestation, so over 6 months. But then ultimately, I got to assist in an abortion procedure, and I watched as a 13-week-old unborn baby fought and struggled for his life inside his mother's womb. And I knew at that time that I had to get out. You know, I didn't know what that was going to look like. I certainly didn't know or think that, you know, I would become this pro-life person that goes around and shares my story. But God certainly had interesting plans for my life. And so that's what I do now. I go around, I expose what's going on inside the abortion industry, try to really, you know, rehumanize these children that are being killed by abortion that unfortunately our society has dehumanized for many years. For almost 42 years through the legalization of abortion in the United States. And I also run an apostolate ministry called And Then There Were None. And we are an organization that proactively reaches into abortion clinics and gets the clinic workers out and gets them into life-affirming work and on the path of healing. And in the past 2.5 years, we've had 137 abortion clinic workers come forward and come through our ministry and receive healing services. And we've been able to thankfully place them all in different lines of work. That's kind of my story in, you know, a nutshell. and I'm just, you know, really thankful that the veil was removed from my eyes and that I was able to really see what I was a part of and get out.
Abby, let me ask you this question. Let's go back to when you were the director at the abortion clinic and you're slowly having these red flags. Mm-hmm. Increasing the abortion quota. Tell us why they want to do that.
Well, for money. Abortion is a cash business for the industry. And it's about 50% of their income. So it's an important stream of income for them. Costs are low. Revenue is high. And so, you know, they want to, I mean, you're basically working in the abortion industry, I mean, you basically become a salesperson for abortion. So you don't really realize it when you're in there, but you're, you know, selling abortion to these vulnerable women that are coming in. And, you know, to be very honest, it's not hard to sell an abortion to a woman who is scared, vulnerable, feeling alone. And so that was basically our job. Our job was not to give them, you know, options counseling, talk to them about other options. Our job, in order to meet our quota, was to sell them an abortion.
Do directors and employees make more money the more abortions that they encourage?
Yeah, so we made bonuses based on meeting our quotas. In some Planned Parenthood clinics, they are compensated per abortion that's performed at the clinic. Now, abortionists, it's basically, I mean, it's they get paid per abortion that they perform. So the money that they make is contingent on the amount of abortions that we can get in the door.
Abby, did you identify that when you were the clinical director of this Planned Parenthood that it seems to me in all of my research that these Planned Parenthoods, which are medical clinics, why are we not holding them to the same standard of like a dental clinic or a doctor's
veterinary clinic?
Correct. And what I mean by that is, you know, my husband happens to be a doctor. He does not get bonuses on pushing surgeries. In fact, that's illegal. He also, you know, you have to come into dental clinics, veterinary clinics, doctor's clinics, and there's a standard of health and cleanliness that I believe is not in the abortion. Why is our government looking the opposite way on these things? In your opinion?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question, right? I mean, I don't know. Why is our government filtering
subsidizing also
half a billion dollars every year to pay for these services? I mean, I don't know.
Right, but they're not giving $500,000 to the pregnancy centers.
Oh, no,
or the
adoption
clinics.
No, they're not getting, they're not getting any government assistance by and large.
Right.
In fact, the pregnancy centers that were doing abstinence-based education in schools, and they were receiving abstinence funding from the government, all of that was pulled several years ago. So it's a constant attack on life. And it's not, you know, people, Obama loves Planned Parenthood. And that's true. But we've been subsidizing Planned Parenthood for dozens of years. This isn't just an Obama problem. This isn't just a Democrat problem. This is a societal problem. It's a systemic problem that, you know, every president in the United States that we have had has been complicit in, you know, that the people that we elect into office, you know, they're not fighting back hard enough on this. And that's why, you know, our votes do matter. People say, oh, well, I live in a blue state or I live in a red state, so my vote doesn't matter. No, your vote does matter.
It does matter.
Because it's those people that are saying, yes, we should go ahead and continue to fund abortion in our country. And, you know, Planned Parenthood will say, well, money is separate. Abortion money is separate from, you know, family planning money, but in reality, the money is all fungible, and at the end of the day, all of the money goes to the same bank account.
Correct.
So, you know, they're pulling money from the government funds that they receive to perform abortion. It's all very transferable. It's all fungible. So, yeah, I mean, but that is the question. Why have we, for decades, allowed this to be subsidized by our tax dollars? I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it is. I don't know it is that Planned Parenthood, you know, this hold that they have on our government, this hold that they have on our society. I think they've basically brainwashed, you know, millions and millions of Americans into believing that if Planned Parenthood were to go away, poor women would have nowhere to go for health care, which is just a blatant lie.
Well, I just want to touch base for 1 minute on voting for pro-life candidates, because I wrote a children's book about this, Julia Learns How to Vote Wisely. And in that, I say that we should be voting for a pro-life candidate, because a lot of people that I sit with that I would assume are pro-life because they're walking the walks with me for pro-life, and they sit on the board with me at my crisis pregnancy center, they are voting for people who are against life. And so I'll very poignantly say to them, you're basically canceling everything that you're doing here at my crisis pregnancy center, helping me do. You just voted somebody in who was going to give money to subsidize, or is going to lift restrictions that somebody else has made. Because it was President Ronald Reagan back in January, 22nd, 1984, you know this, he was the first one to declare National Sanctity of Human Life Day. He is why our whole month in January, he's the president. He was very pro-life. And then whether you like Bush or you dislike what Bush did, the whole Bush dynasty, they are all very pro-life. And then, of course, we have people like Clinton who did not honor the Sanctity of Life Day. And again, I don't want to go down a path of if you like everything that they do, but there are absolutely candidates, presidential, Congress people here in the great state of Pennsylvania. Joe Pitts is a great pro-life advocate for us, and we have lots of others. But it is absolutely vital that those of us who believe that we are pro-life advocates, we have to make our vote count in that direction. So,
absolutely. And that's the thing I talk about. I mean, I'm Roman Catholic. I mean, Obama is in office. I mean, I'm just going to go kind of brazenly say this, but Obama is in office because of the pro-life Catholic vote. And 51% of Catholics voted for Obama. I mean, 51% of Catholics. I mean, our church teaches abortion.
And that's disgusting.
Under no exception.
I'm going to tell you right now, it's disgusting.
I'm
a Christian. I'm not Catholic, but only 24% of Christians got up off the sofa and went to vote, which is disgusting also.
Yeah. I mean, this is on us. I mean, this is on, I'm Roman Catholic. I'm Christian too, but this is on us. I mean, this
correct.
Is on
if we're not going to stand up for
population.
This evil.
Yeah.
Right. If we're not going to fight against this evil, nobody else is going to do it, Abby.
Right.
So let's go back to, you said that you were pushing for aborting up to 25 weeks, and that when you went in and helped with a 13-week abortion, that's when it hit you that this is a life, because the baby's trying to thrive and survive, and we're snuffing out this life. So what do you think it is, since you were on the inside, you had this enlightening moment where you thought, gosh, I mean, I can only imagine what you were thinking, Abby. I would probably thinking, I'm teaching my children. I have three little girls. I'm teaching my children that we protect the trees. I'm teaching my children that we protect tadpoles and we protect butterflies. Why am I not teaching my children that we protect this 13-week-old fetus? Why isn't everybody else, and I don't even like to call it a fetus, baby, why are we not, why aren't other people, women, waking up to what you saw?
Well, I mean, we have a problem in this country with, women. There's this big campaign right now. Oh, it's not one in three women having abortions. Well,
I read that.
The numbers don't lie, right? I mean, it is, if it's not one in three, it's one in four. And either way, it's too many women.
And it's too many babies and it's too many daddies.
Yeah, it's too many women. And, about 50% of abortions are repeat abortions. So, I mean, we're looking at this, huge number. I mean, huge number of abortions taking place. Almost 70% of abortions coming from inside our churches. So the problem is that, women are having abortions and then they are justifying their sin by continuing to promote abortion to other people. I mean, look, 70% of abortion clinic workers have had abortions themselves. Somebody grows up wanting to work in an abortion clinic, right? But it's a series of choices and decisions that lead you inside of those clinic doors, whether it's to have an abortion or to work for an abortion clinic. And it's simple. It's justification of our own sin. So, we've been complicit in the act of abortion. We've paid for abortions. Men have paid for abortions. They've talked their girlfriends into having abortions. And we're not just talking about single people. We're talking about married people, too. About 25% of women that have abortions are married. So, you know, it's just kind of a destruction of life, not just among single people. I think, you know, we kind of think, oh, it's these young, poor teenagers that are getting pregnant. But the by and large, the vast majority of women are in their late 20s who are having abortions. And, you know, about a quarter of them are married. You know, we're talking about women. We're not talking about uneducated women. They know that they're pregnant. They know that they're pregnant with a baby. They know that it's a human life. They know that it's alive. But they have believed the lie that our society has ingrained in many people that you're going to have a baby and you're going to bring this baby into a situation that does not scream perfection, okay, that it's like, you know, not such an ideal situation, that the most compassionate thing, the most merciful thing that you can do for your unborn baby is to kill it. And that's the lie that many Christians have believed. That is the lie that many, you know, women, and that is the lie that, unfortunately, the majority of our society believes.
Abby, you said that when you started working at Planned Parenthood, you thought that you were actually doing something really helpful for women. So they must be really getting their message out that they're very loving to women. What do you have to say about that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you'll never see an abortion clinic ad. You'll never see a Planned Parenthood ad that says, you know, we are just so excited about all these abortions we performed last year. No, it's about health care. It's about prevention, about education, providing cancer screenings. You know, all of these different things that, you know, that women and men will need in their lifetime. And so that's what I thought I was going in there to do. And I, you know, originally thought for 8 years that really, you know, our goal was to reduce the abortion rate. We didn't want women to have abortions. It was just an unfortunate thing that some women needed to choose sometimes. But it wasn't until I really got into upper management that I started to see that, you know, our goal was to increase abortion. Our goal was to sell abortion. And unfortunately, myself and many other people we had become pawns in the abortion industry, and we had just been believing a lie, some of us for many years.
So, Abby, would you say that in your experience, Planned Parenthood does a good job blanketing their real mission, which is just to push and sell abortions? Because I know I have friends who are very liberal in this area, and they will say things like, I would never have an abortion. However, you can't take that choice away from someone else. And that's why it's good to have places like Planned Parenthood, because I think that they believe that Planned Parenthood, when you go in there, they sit you down and say, okay, well, here's all of your options. There's a lovely adoption place down there, and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. But in reality, everything that I've read, and I do have some friends, excellent friends, that have had 2-3 abortions, and then they realize that it was wrong. And now they are pro-life advocates like you are. They're on the speaking circuit. And they said when they went to Planned Parenthood that no one ever brought up adoption, never said that, never gave them any other options.
Yeah, so Planned Parenthood's abortion counselor training actually says that we should not talk to them about other options, because we don't want to confuse women who are coming in seeking information on abortion, that we are only to talk about abortion. And that makes sense, right? Because it makes sense for Planned Parenthood, because Planned Parenthood doesn't make money if a woman chooses to parent her child, because they don't provide any prenatal care. They don't make money on a woman who decides to place her child for adoption, because they're not in that business. They only make money if a woman chooses to have an abortion. And so it's a business model. It's a business. It's an industry. I mean, I remember sitting in a meeting one time with our COO, and she said, being a nonprofit is a tax status, not a business status. And that is the mindset of Planned Parenthood. They're not there to be charitable. They're not giving anything away for free. I mean, that's kind of the misnomer, like, well, women can go there and get free health care. Well, it's not free. Somebody's paying for it. Taxpayers are paying for it. Nothing that they do is free. Nothing that they do is charitable. Nothing that they do is out of the goodness of their heart. They're providing these services because they're getting paid, and they're getting paid a lot of money to do it. I mean, that's the bottom line. So what you said is absolutely correct. Planned Parenthood has something to sell. They have a product to sell, and that is abortion. And even the women that come in to get contraception, I mean, I have to take a pretty strong stance against contraception in the first place, but 54% of women having abortions were using contraception at the time that they got pregnant. And so the goal of Planned Parenthood is, you know, let's get them in. Let's get them on a birth control method. Let's get them on a birth control method that has a high human error rate, failure rate, so that, you know, when that birth control does fail and they do ovulate, because about 50% of the time women ovulate anyway on birth control, you know, when they do ovulate and they get pregnant, then they'll already have a rapport with us, and they'll come back to us and we'll solve their problem. And we'll take $500 for it.
Exactly.
And, I mean, that is the goal of Planned Parenthood. Same reason they go into the public school system and try to educate our kids. Their sex ed curriculum begins in kindergarten with five-year-olds, and the goal is not really to educate them on sex or their bodies. Their goal is to develop a rapport with these young children so that when they do start to have sexual feelings, when they start to have these different experiences or, you know, or want to explore different things, Planned Parenthood will actually tell them, the educator will tell them, when you start to have these feelings, don't go to your parents because your parents don't understand and they will shame you. You come to me. I'm a trusted advisor for you. I've been with you since you were a little kid, and now you can trust me to come to me at Planned Parenthood with any questions you have without judgment. That time, they will put these 12 and 13-year-old girls on birth control pills, knowing good and well that they're not going to take that pill responsibly. They're going to end up pregnant, and Planned Parenthood will be there to provide that abortion without parental consent.
Frightening. Let me ask you this question. They are not going into every school. They have to come and talk to my superintendent or my principal and say, we want to come in, and then the principal has to allow them to come in, correct?
Sometimes it's a principal. Sometimes it's a school health advisory committee. So,
but they have to come and ask permission to come into
that school. They have to come and ask.
Okay.
And, you know, they come in with this curriculum that's, you know, supposedly all research-based, saying, you know, oh, this is the right way to do it. They just kind of gloss over abstinence. Like, well, you could choose abstinence, but nobody's going to do that. So let me tell you about the wonderful world of birth control.
Right, right.
And so that's, you know, but they're not talking about the birth control risks. They're not talking about the abortifacient
STDs.
Property of birth control. They're not talking about, well, they are talking about STDs, but they're basically saying, it's fine if you have sex, just wear a condom, and then you won't get an STD. I mean, they're just kind of glossing over it. And they're not talking about the physical, emotional, and spiritual repercussions of having sex before marriage. They're not talking about those boundary issues. They're not talking about any of that. They're not talking about, you know, the hormonal attachment that a woman has to a man after she has sex with him. They're not talking about any of that, because in their world, anything goes, and promiscuous sex is good sex. And in fact, there's a brochure, anybody listening could go to Google, and they could Google it. It's by Planned Parenthood. It's called Healthy, Happy, and Hot. And they're not talking about temperature. It was geared for kids aged 8 to 16, and it has very graphic details about masturbation. It has, it even talks about STDs. It says in there that if you have an STD, or even if you're HIV positive, that you absolutely under no circumstance have to tell your partner. You do not have to disclose your STD status to the person that you're having sex with. It is absolutely disgusting.
Selfish.
That, remember, is put out for kids starting at age 8.
It's disgusting.
And, you know, this is something that the Girl Scouts pumped out. You know, they supported Healthy, Happy, and Hot. They support Planned Parenthood. I mean, this is something. Our children are being indoctrinated everywhere we turn, and we as parents have to fight really hard, and we have to be very vigilant about the activities we allow our kids to be in, the programs that we allow them to participate in, and what's taking place at their school.
I agree with you, and I am going to piggyback on that and say to all of our families who are listening, they should be calling their schools today and confirm that Planned Parenthood is not coming in and doing sex ed. Girl Scouts, call up your Cub Scout leader, whatever it is. My girls are not in Cub Scouts. We do our church thing. And make sure that Planned Parenthood is not coming in and indoctrinating your kids. And if they are, I would make a huge stink about it and pull my kids out.
Well, and the thing about Girl Scouts is that it doesn't even matter if the local troop is involved. If they sell cookies, if they buy uniforms, if they buy badges, if they pay national dues, which all four of those things is something that's required by all local Girl Scout troops, then they are contributing money to Planned Parenthood.
Okay,
and not only are they contributing money to the abortion industry, but they're also contributing money to organizations that are attempting to legalize prostitution all across the country.
Okay, so you're educating me and you're educating my listeners right now. So you're telling me that Girl Scouts of America gives money to Planned Parenthood, and Planned Parenthood also gives money to Girl Scouts?
Planned Parenthood does not give money to Girl Scouts, but Girl Scouts gives money to Planned Parenthood.
Unbelievable. So we should all be boycotting Girl Scout cookies, as far as I'm concerned, and everything Girl Scouts. Thank you for educating us on that. We're going to have a whole other program on that, Abby. Okay. So let's bring you up to the new Abby Johnson. Now you are a pro-life advocate. You've written this book, Unplanned. Tell us how exciting this has been for you. And I want to know, because I'm sure that you have haters and you have harassers. How are you dealing with that?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, you know, honestly, the majority, if I'm going to get like a hate email, it's going to be someone who claims to be pro-life because, you know, many pro-lifers, they just, I don't know, they just have kind of a chip on their shoulder about abortion clinic workers. They lack forgiveness and, you know, they don't want us in the pro-life movement because we've killed babies. And pro-choicers, you know, they do hard of a time, actually. Actually, when my book came out, I got several really nice emails from pro-choicers saying, you know, your book made me think. I'm still pro-choice, but it did, you know, it did cause me to question Planned Parenthood and, you know, caused me to question kind of where my line in the sand is on abortion. And, you know, I just want to tell you that I appreciate you not vilifying those of us in the pro-choice movement. And that's really important because if we seek conversion, which should be definitely our goal in the pro-life movement is, you know, conversion of hearts, women who are, you know, in crisis pregnancies, people who work at the abortion clinics, abortion doctors, our politicians. I mean, all, you know, we're in this for conversion of hearts. So if that's truly our goal, then we have to come with, you know, an open dialogue and kindness and gentleness, but also truth, but truth and love and truth and charity. And so I don't hear too much from pro-choicers. I think the abortion industry would just like to pretend that I don't exist. And they would like me to go away, so I don't hear from them too often.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear. I assumed that your haters were from the pro-choice side, and I'm sorry to hear that those of us who are pro-life are not embracing you and, you know, identifying that Providence, you know, we all have a history, and thankfully you're using your history for good, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people, you know, my prayer has always been that God will turn my mess into a message. And, there, you know, there's going to be, I mean, we all have something back. I mean, we're all sinners. So, mm-hmm. You know, we're all sinners saved by grace. So, I mean, it's hard. I mean, people, you know, they come around. And I think this idea of abortion clinic workers coming forward, I think it was kind of a new concept, you know, when I came out. I mean, I was the first person to come out in many, many years. And kind of start exposing the abortion industry. So I think it was kind of new for a lot of people, and I think it was hard to offer forgiveness and mercy to someone who had participated in such heinous things. Mm-hmm. But even some of those people that were really hardened toward me in the beginning, you know, many of them have come back and said, you know what, you know, my heart wasn't right on this, and, you know, I apologize. And that's been really nice. But, you know, there's always going to be people that are skeptical. There's always going to be people that say, look, no matter how much good you do, it's never going to make up for, you know, what you did in the abortion industry. And that's okay. I mean, you know, we know that we're going to be persecuted. And
that's right.
I mean, no persecution that I receive is anything compared to what Christ receives. So,
no, that's right.
You know, I just take it in stride, call myself blessed to be doing this work for God. And, you know, I just keep moving forward.
And Abby, just to encourage you, because I'm getting persecuted on some of the children's books that I've written, you know, we're being persecuted because of Christ. It's not me mm-hmm. that they dislike or you that they dislike. It's Christ that they dislike. And that always helps me feel right. A little bit better and a little more supported. So now you're doing this fabulous work where you are going into abortion clinics. And you said that so far 137 abortion clinicians have left the industry and they're doing life-affirming work. Is that the most exciting thing that you're doing right now, the most unexpected? I mean, you probably never thought that you'd be able to go into
this. It is the best thing that I do with, you know, the work that I do. I absolutely love it. I mean, I know that this is, I knew from the beginning that, you know, I wanted to do some kind of work with abortion clinic workers. I had no idea what that was going to look like. And when my book came out, you know, I had a bunch of abortion clinic workers that had read it. And they may have picked it up originally as a critic, but then by the end of it, they found some truth in it. They realized, hey, you know, this is true. This is what I'm dealing with, and I don't want to work here anymore either. And so because the response from abortion clinic workers was so overwhelming, we decided, okay, we need to actually turn this into something real. We need to make this an organization. And, you know, I mean, I couldn't even believe it. I mean, after 40 years in more than 40 years of legalized abortion in this country, there had never been a national movement to actually reach into the clinics and get these workers out. And that's, I mean, like, whistleblower cases, I mean, that's how you take down an industry, right? That's how you take down, how you expose corruption, is to get people from the inside talking. And so, you know, that's what we want to do. But our primary goal is really to help these workers seek healing and to bring them back to Christ, or to bring them to Christ for the first time. And it's been just wildly successful. I mean, anything, I mean, only something God could do. I mean, just,
it's miraculous.
Beyond anything that we could have ever expected or, you know, planned for or anything like that. So, you know, but God just keeps blessing us, and gosh, we're amazed and surprised and just stand in awe every day of what he's doing.
So if we want to find more about what you are doing, Abby, we should go to abbyjohnson.org.
Yeah, you can go to my blog, or you can go, if you want more information about our ministry and Then There Were None, you can go to our website. It's abortionworker.com. And, you know, I always encourage people, if you're one of the people, you know, that go out to the sidewalk and pray and, you know, try to reach out to women going in, you know, also take that same amount of time to reach out to the workers going in. You know, like I said, 70% of the workers that are inside of these abortion clinics are post-abortive. And so they need healing, just like the women coming out of the abortion clinics do. And we need to treat them with care and love and compassion and tenderness. And so, you know, even if they won't talk to you, just, you know, yell out, go to abortionworker.com. There's help for you. And, you know, we're getting emails. I mean, we literally get emails from workers every week. And, you know, we're helping people transition out. So we know what we're doing. We're experienced. We take confidentiality very seriously with our ministry. We have had a few workers leave from Pennsylvania. So that's been very exciting.
Yay.
So we've had workers leave from almost every state. So it's been really good.
Very exciting. Well, God bless you richly in all of your endeavors in 2015. What are your goals for 2015? Can you share that with us?
You know, just to continue to expand our abortion worker ministry. We have some big plans on the horizon for And Then There Were None, and we're just praying that God will provide funding and the resources that we need. And he's provided beyond everything we could have even expected. So we know that's going to happen. And, you know, our goal is just to close down these clinics. We've got several lawsuits pending right now with former abortion clinic workers who have come through our ministry. Just, you know, these workers exposing what's really taking place inside the industry. And it's going to be a good year. Good things are happening.
Abby Johnson, thank you for being with us. She's the author of Unplanned 2011. I encourage you to get her book. She is a former abortion clinic director. Now she is a pro-life advocate and champion. And Then There Were None. Check out her website at abbyjohnson.org. Hi, this is Carla Tedesi, author of the Julia Learns book series and host of Your Family Matters here at 1180 WFYL. Let's make 2015 the year that we read quality books to our children, the future leaders of this country. Please start with my book series, Julia Learns How to Vote Wisely and Julia Learns How to Marry Wisely. Julia Learns How to Vote Wisely is instructing our children to vote with conservative values and the importance of planting those seeds deeply into our children's hearts at an early age. Julia Learns How to Marry Wisely is planting seeds deeply for truth and nobility and righteousness that we see in traditional marriage. They are the only books that are sharing this message with our children, the future leaders of the United States of America. And please keep a lookout for a third book that will be launched this April 2015, Julia Learns How to Protect Life Wisely. Remember, today's readers are tomorrow's future leaders.
Julia Learns series is available as ebooks, printed books, and on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other Christian retailers.